Hello, and welcome to the Love Mia Vita podcast. I'm Jerry DiPiano, CEO of FemPharma. Thank you for joining me as we discuss all things women's health and wellness. Please note that this information is simply that. It's information to help you to think through your decisions. Please consult your medical practitioner to discuss your personal situation. Thank you. So here we are again, Catherine, you and I, Catherine Sharif, my co-host on the Love Mia Vita podcast, discussing some of our favorite topics, women's health care, and all the things that impact women. And today we are going to be discussing something that is at top of mind for a lot of us, and that is how we manage our weight. And specifically, given that we have some newer products that are available, specifically the GLP-1s, there are a number of them out on the marketplace. These are the drugs that the new weight loss drugs that have shown that you can take off not just a few pounds, but 10, 20, 30 pounds. And they come in a number of different forms, some injectable, there are oral forms. But we thought that we would start off with a little bit of a primer on the GLP-1s. Maybe, Catherine, you can discuss what is the GLP-1? What does it stand for? And a little bit about its background.
Sure. So GLP-1 receptor agonists, which is a mouthful, that stands for glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists. And they originated from research on the Gila monster. Researchers were looking at the saliva of the Gila monster and how it manages glucose metabolism. And they found that there was this protein called amylin, which controlled hunger in the Gila monster. And amylin was converted to, so amylin is the protein, and it was first converted to exenatide by a drug company, which became the first GLP-1 drug, and it was released on the market in 2006. So our viewers might be surprised to know that these drugs have been around since 2006. And basically, they were developed to control diabetes, and they found that there was this wonderful side effect of weight loss. And that's because when you use the GLP-1s, they're very efficient at releasing insulin, but they also decrease appetite by slowing your stomach down. And so when your stomach doesn't empty right away, you have slightly delayed gastric emptying, you feel fuller, and it increases the hormones in your brain that tell you you're full. So what a lot of people tell us is that when they take them, they have less food chatter, and they don't have to just keep thinking about what am I going to eat next and look in the kitchen and get distracted by food. So they came on the market in 2006. And because it's a protein, because all these drugs are proteins, they're mostly injectable, because if you take a protein by mouth, it would break down in your stomach. So as you said, there is one that is oral, semaglutide, it's a pretty low dose. So it's not that great for diabetes yet until it's in higher doses, but the rest of them are injections, and they go, they're injected right under the skin. That way we bypass digestion.
Right. So it actually, so we need to do this as an injectable form if we wanted to use it as a significant opportunity for weight loss. But there is some work that's underway, some research that's underway to develop products that can be consumed orally or in different routes of administration, because not everybody is comfortable doing an injection. So stay tuned, because we keep working on those types of products. But today we want to specifically discuss how these GLP-1s may or may not be beneficial in women's health care. starting with women of reproductive age, because there are some places where the GLP-1s could actually be beneficial for women who are in their reproductive age. But we also want to exert a cautionary note because there are also some places where women want to avoid use of GLP-1s, or at least be prepared with, especially if they're thinking about pregnancy, because we know that these products weren't tested in pregnancy. That's a different podcast for why certain women aren't included in clinical trials. We should go into that in a different podcast. Nonetheless, we don't have really good data on pregnant women, so we want to explain a little bit about some of the conditions where these products, these GLP-1s, could be beneficial. And obviously, we will give you a cautionary warning in terms of how to consult with your healthcare practitioner about the areas where you may want to consider different forms of birth control, et cetera. So let's talk about, first of all, why GLP-1s in younger women? I mean, obesity. That's the key issue that we're speaking of here is obesity.
Right. So they're on the market with two indications. They have one name if they're used for diabetes, and they have another name if they're used for weight loss. And generally, to qualify for their use as in weight loss, you have to have a body mass index of 30 or higher. And for those of you who are not familiar with body mass index, it takes the height and the weight and spits out a number, and a normal, ostensibly normal body mass index is under 25. It's debatable, but so a body mass index of 30 means maybe you're about 5'4 and 190 pounds. That would give you a body mass index of 30 or up. And that's when it's used for weight loss. That's the qualification. Most insurance companies now will cover it for diabetes. So usually that's not a problem. But for weight loss, it's a struggle. And as of January 1st, 2025, the insurance companies have made it much more difficult to get these drugs for weight loss. In the last three, let's see, the last 3 days that I've been seeing patients, I have had one woman each day who was well into the 300s, body mass index in the 50s or even 60s, and the drug was denied by three different insurance companies that said, we just don't cover weight loss drugs. So the prices are very high. So even if your body mass index is over 30, it may not be covered.
And I should say that Dr. Sharif is a professor of medicine at Thomas Jefferson University, and she also sees patients, women and men, but her specialty is women. She is an internal medicine specialist. So she really does have a handle on both the insurance and the qualifying factors for many of these types of conditions. So when we talk about obesity as a risk factor for women in the reproductive age group cohort, there are a number of different reasons that one may consider this as a plan for addressing obesity as a risk factor for things like pregnancy or for certain health conditions like polycystic ovarian syndrome or endometriosis. Maybe you could share a little bit about that.
Sure. So in 2006, the first GLP-1 receptor agonist came on the market, exenatide, and it was a twice a day injection. And one of its mechanisms of action is allowing us to release insulin more efficiently. And so if you are insulin resistant, you require a lot of insulin to metabolize your food. When you use these drugs, they tell the body that you are more insulin sensitive. They release insulin very quickly. It does the job and it disappears. And then you don't have this growth hormone, insulin, that's going around in the body for hours, making you gain weight, right? Because it's such a potent growth hormone. So I started using it in patients with polycystic ovary syndrome in 2006, and their insulin levels came down, which means that the insulin stopped telling the ovaries to make too much testosterone, so they started to ovulate, and many of them believed that they could never get pregnant, and we talked about the possibility of pregnancy with these drugs. And many women did become pregnant because they didn't use contraception because they were used to not ovulating, and they lost they became pregnant for several reasons. One is their testosterone went down. Number two, they lost weight, and that also makes your insulin and your testosterone go down. And so we have a lot of babies in the last 19 years that have been conceived on GLP-1s. And what the data shows is that those babies are okay. So what's happened for most of those babies is that once women realized they were pregnant, they stopped taking the drug. And so we've had an experiment of sorts that was uncontrolled since it wasn't studied in pregnant women. Now, I also started using it in women who were overweight without polycystic ovary syndrome, and it's been very effective. And some of them work better than the others. So the ones that have received so much publicity, semaglutide and tirzepatide, in the last few years, the reason people know about them because the weight loss is so spectacular. So in the past, with the older ones, people would lose 20, 30, 40, sometimes more, but nothing like the way the drugs are today. From what I hear, and you may know more about this, there are several coming in 2026 that will be even more powerful than the two that we the two most currently powerful ones that we have.
It's interesting too that obesity in reproductive age women can also increase the risk of adverse pregnancy outcomes. And I know we discussed that. There's another podcast that we did on cardiometabolic issues. And if our listeners and viewers haven't had the opportunity, you should check that one out as well. But the metabolic status of the mom is thought to impact the long-term health of her offspring. And so if you are contemplating pregnancy, you may want to consider, if you are obese, some of the factors that could impact a successful pregnancy, including some of the things that might take place during your pregnancy. So I thought we might want to chat a little bit about that with for our audience.
Sure. So, pregnancy is an insulin resistant state, meaning that when you have this tiny fetus who's no bigger than a thumbtack, they certainly don't come out that way. They come out like this huge, giant, 8 pound baby. And how does that happen? How do they grow so rapidly, increasing millions of times their size within 9 months? It's because the mom makes insulin. So insulin is such a powerful growth hormone. So if mom is insulin resistant to begin with, and she has this baby, she will produce more and more and more insulin to get the baby to grow. And then what happens is you have babies that are heavier than they should be. It can make delivery difficult, but also metabolically, it's not healthy for the baby. Women with insulin resistance are more likely to have preeclampsia, high blood pressures during pregnancy, and gestational diabetes. And when babies are exposed to moms with preeclampsia and gestational diabetes, they don't have the same health as a baby who wasn't exposed to that. So then they're at higher risk for insulin resistance and so on.
So if you are a woman who is obese and you're in your reproductive age group cohort, let's say you're between the ages of whatever that is up to 40s, whenever you can no longer conceive, or some women can conceive in their 40s, depends on whether they're perimenopausal. And we know that some women conceive in perimenopause, so don't be caught off guard. But let's say you are a woman who's contemplating pregnancy and you happen to have a very high BMI. Is it something you might want to consider? And again, we're not trying to promote GLP-1s here. We're really just sharing some information, and that's something you need to discuss with your healthcare practitioner. So Dr. Sharif is not practicing medicine during the podcast.
That's right. So for my patients who are overweight, whether or not they want to conceive, I want them to be at the healthiest weight. And so I do offer them GLP-1s and especially if they're trying to conceive or thinking about it in the next year or so. Now, there's been some publicity that GLP-1s reduce the effectiveness of birth control pills, and it's not quite clear, and I'll tell you why. So when you take a GLP-1, we talked about how your stomach slows down. So if your birth control pill is sitting in there, it may not be absorbed. I think the jury is still out on that.
We just don't know enough because we haven't done the studies. This is where it's important to continue to do women's health care research and to enroll women, more women, in these studies, particularly as we look at where they are in their, if they're women who are still in their reproductive age group cohort, still menstruating. We have to look at where they are in their cycle to be able to determine how these drugs behave differently. So more to come on that subject. But as you indicated, because there is some uncertainty, the recommendation is to use a double barrier method of contraception. So if you are using an oral contraceptive, you may want to have your partner use a condom, or you may want to use a sperm immobilizer, and there is at least one of those products that is on the market today. But you ought to think about how to protect yourself during that period of time, so that you are not dealing with uncertainty for the next 10 months. And I think that's the message here. These products do come with a warning, and so we're not sharing anything that isn't already on the warning for these types of products. We talked about some other benefits for women, and we talked about inflammation. So thinking about a condition like endometriosis and potential beneficial impact on endometriosis, which can be considered an inflammatory condition. Any thoughts on that?
Yes. So, like many health conditions, inflammation underlies endometriosis. So, when we decrease inflammation, certain things get better. For example, fatty liver improves when people are on GLP-1s. Even if they haven't lost weight yet, they have less inflammation. What I'd love to see is if we could improve symptoms of endometriosis with GLP-1s. But they could also work with in a different way. For example, if you are overweight and your fat cells are estrogen factories, if you're producing more estrogen at higher weights, that may make your endometriosis worse, right? Because high estrogen is linked with endometriosis. If you lose weight, you have fewer estrogen factories. So theoretically, the endometriosis could get better. But we know that the GLP-1s also directly suppress inflammatory cytokines. And those are chemicals that are produced by the white blood cells that cause inflammation. Some interesting things we've noticed in our practices is that people have less of an urge to drink alcohol, which is very interesting. Not just less of an interest in eating, but alcohol. That's been very gratifying. People also report, and this is not a study, but this is my observation with hundreds and hundreds of patients in the last 19 years, There's a sense of well-being, and it isn't just related to, well, I lost 5 pounds or 20 pounds and I feel better about myself, but it could be that inflammation underlies our mood, anxiety, and that's why people have a sense of well-being. Even slender women who take the GLP-1s, they don't have a body mass index over 30, but they take it for another reason, let's say diabetes. They actually say that I feel normal, I can think more clearly, and it makes you wonder about inflammation.
So again, there's further exploration that is needed, looking at things like whether it helps with different forms of addiction, whether that's alcohol addiction or nicotine addiction. We know food, obviously it has a deter it deters us from eating, and certainly eating can be an addiction. So lots more to come. There are some additional investigations that are underway. Let's move into perimenopause and menopause, because we know that that is a time when there is a significant amount of hormone fluctuation, and the impact of GLP-1s, or I should say, maybe we should start with hormones and weight gain, and then the impact of GLP-1s as women think about where they are in the menopause transition.
The GLP-1s can be helpful in overcoming insulin resistance. And again, you've mentioned this. I don't want this to sound like a commercial for the GLP-1s, but this is how they work.
I think as we share information with women who are listening to these podcasts, one of the things that is important for them to recognize is that we are sharing information as a form of empowerment. We know that there's information that is available to them on the internet, and Dr. Google and AI may or may not be the best resources. So we want to bring well-vetted, well-researched information to women. So again, it's really to illuminate the conversation around these kinds of products, because let's face it, we see an advertisement about every 6 seconds on TV, and we're reading about it as we look at our YouTube, and we look at Hulu, we're seeing these ads. So we need to be able to understand what are the risks, what are the benefits. And again, we at FemPharma, who sponsor this podcast, don't sell a GLP-1. So we don't have a dog in the hunt. It's
Right.
all about empowering women with knowledge. So we talk about our cardiovascular health and cardiometabolic health as we change. And obviously, there are consequences to weight gain. We know that the hormones, estrogen and progesterone, are fluctuating during this period of time. You described the weight gain. With cardiovascular health and cardiometabolic health, if women are gaining large amounts of weight, and particularly around the midsection, right? So we hear a lot about belly bloat, right? Skinny legs, but we have this fat middle. And that really is that should be a first sign that we need to do something.
Yes.
So maybe we could talk about a little bit about their benefiting for cardiometabolic health.
Well, they're so beneficial for cardiometabolic health that at least one of the GLP-1s has received an indication to treat people with who have established cardiovascular disease, like coronary artery disease, because it's been shown to decrease future heart attacks. They are that powerful.
So that's one issue that you may want to take into consideration. So if you know that you have issues with your cardiometabolic health and you are overweight, you may or may not have diabetes, but if you have some of these risk factors, that would be another reason to explore further use or use of one of these GLP-1s. And then we talk about some of the menopausal symptoms, hot flashes. Let's talk about a hot flash. And now we can stratify the group of women. There are some women who are using hormone replacement therapy, and there are some women who choose not to use hormone replacement therapy. So, thoughts on that?
So you mean with respect to the
GLP-1s.
GLP-1?
Yes.
Yeah, so since if when we say hormone replacement therapy, I'm always thinking we're using estradiol on the skin and we're avoiding going through the liver, not taking it orally. And when you do use it as a patch or a gel on the skin, it makes you more insulin sensitive. We don't know by how much because there's so few studies, but this is a property of estradiol. And the doses that are in hormone replacement therapy are much lower than what's in the birth control pill. So sometimes women gain weight with the birth control pill, but those are very high doses of estrogen, and it's also not identical to what we produce. So if estradiol can make you more insulin sensitive, and if GLP-1s can make you more insulin sensitive, it wouldn't be surprising if they had a synergistic effect in terms of weight loss.
So this is another area of exploration. There are some retrospective analyses that are available. However, they are just that, retrospective. So again, not to be pedantic about this, but it's a look back. So it's a look back at women who were using hormone replacement therapy and they were using GLP-1s at the same time, so concomitantly. And then there are those individuals that just use the GLP-1s. The jury is still out. There was some discussion around the amplified impact for the GLP-1s in conjunction with certain forms of, as you pointed out, certain forms of hormone replacement therapy. This is really an area that requires more research, more investigation, and absolutely a conversation with your healthcare practitioner. Not all women are eligible for the use of hormone replacement therapy. So that's one consideration. Not all women are eligible for the use of GLP-1s. But if you think you may be a candidate and you just heard some of the reasons why it may be something to consider, particularly if you have certain risk factors, then this is an area of opportunity for you to take this information back to your healthcare practitioner. And I always recommend that since doctors like Dr. Sharif are so busy, probably seeing 35 patients a day, then having to report all this in the system, it's probably a good idea to write it down. Keep it in a notebook or in a diary. Show up with your notes, ask your questions, take notes, and then go back and think about it. And if you don't get the answers that you're looking for, I always say, do your due diligence and find another doctor. Get a second opinion.
Yes.
Nothing wrong with getting a second opinion.
Not at all. It's your right.
So I think we've covered a lot of territory. Are there any points that you would like to leave with our target audience?
Yeah, I guess a couple of things. One of the recent GLP-1s now has an indication for sleep apnea. So if you have obstructive sleep apnea, those of you who have it and then have used CPAP successfully to treat your sleep apnea, you can tell us about what a game changer CPAP is and what it's like not to sleep night after night after night, and the chronic fatigue and the that you have for years. So the when you de when you use a GLP-1, you can actually begin to make the sleep apnea milder and then maybe even disappear with enough weight loss. So these drugs are really game changers for sleep apnea. I would like to talk about some of the side effects. So almost everybody has side effects, but most people don't have to stop the drugs because of the side effects, but they can be severe. So one side effect is nausea. If your stomach doesn't empty and it just feels like the food is sitting there or it's coming up a little bit or you're getting heartburn, you can get some pretty severe nausea. And the way to mitigate that is to start with very low doses and eat carefully and see how you metabolize, how much you have to eat before you would get sick. Don't eat too fast. Also, fatty foods tend to stay in your stomach longer. So there are some foods that people will avoid because they'll feel sicker. Some people have nausea that's so bad that they vomit. For most people, the nausea wears off, and then if you can tolerate, then you go to the next higher dose and the next higher dose. If your stomach slows down, you can also have constipation. The whole GI tract slows down, and you can get very uncomfortable. And I've had a couple of patients who were admitted to the hospital. We thought they had an obstruction. They hadn't had bowel movements for days, nausea and vomiting, and it was all due to the GLP-1. So you can get severe constipation, and you can anticipate it. You can treat it early on. Other people get diarrhea, and I'm not sure why they would get diarrhea instead of constipation. There are some warnings about pancreatitis, pancreatic cancer, and gallbladder attacks. Haven't seen pancreatitis unless it was due to a gallbladder attack. Now, how could these drugs cause a gallbladder attack? It's pretty simple. It's not a direct effect of the drug. But what happens is if you lose weight very rapidly, 20 pounds, 30 pounds in just a few months, all your cells contain cholesterol in the cell membrane. And what happens is, so the cells break down because you're losing weight. The cholesterol ends up in the gallbladder, and then there's such a high concentration, you start to form cholesterol crystals, and then you end up with gallstones. And if you have a gallstone that's blocking the pancreas and not just the gallbladder, that's where you'll have pancreatitis.
These are all very helpful in considering what you may want to do with respect to use of one of these products. And in every one of these cases, what Dr. Sharif has shared with you is on the label of these products. So you get an insert with these products. If these things happened in a clinical trial, they will be reported out on the labeling. So it is advisable to keep that in consideration. And it's also advisable if you have any other comorbidities, other co-occurring conditions, that you are honest with your healthcare practitioner because it could impact the way in which these drugs work for you or cause significant side effects. So great advice, Catherine. Really appreciate that.
Sure. I'm so interested to see what's going to happen in the next few years because we know that some have already gone generic. Those are the older ones that have, they still have weight loss. It's just not as spectacular. But we have new drugs that are coming that are more effective, have fewer side effects, and some will be oral, and doses that we can use in diabetes. We even use these drugs in patients with type 1 diabetes, not just type 2 diabetes, because when you are injecting yourself with insulin, it's not as elegant as when the body releases insulin. So you have insulin that you're trying to guess the best way to dose yourself. And many people with type 1 diabetes gain a lot of weight because of insulin. And then the GLP-1s help them use insulin more easily. And they are able to get to a healthy weight.
Very, very interesting. And so, if you are an individual listening or watching this and you have type 1 diabetes, you and your healthcare practitioner hasn't mentioned this, again, this is an area where you bring the information to your healthcare practitioner and ask the questions. Am I eligible for this? The last point that I wanted to make, and it's an important point, and it's really around the research. It is so important that if you are watching or listening to these podcasts, that you understand that it is so critical to do more research in women's healthcare because most of the drugs that were developed, including the ones that we are speaking about, were largely studied in a male population, and women were largely excluded if they were of reproductive age. But even as women progress into perimenopause and menopause, we really don't have a lot of strong data to understand and appreciate how they work efficiently, effectively, and what the right dose and dosage regimen may be. So please support women's healthcare research so that we can better understand the uniquely designed and developed products for women in all categories.
Absolutely.
Catherine, thank you once again. It's always
Thank you,
great to have
Terry.
you as our co-host on the Love Me Evita podcast. And we'll see you next time. Be well.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us on the Love Me Evita podcast. Love Me Evita means love my life, and that is a mantra we should all live by. Please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and check out our website at fempharma.com. Remember to live well and love Mia Vita.